This is March 4th, 2018. March 4th is the one day of the year that's a command. And we'll be stepping back and looking at the broader culture of Western Buddhism, of which we are a part. Well, even to say that, some people may not accept that. There are people here, or people hearing this Taisho, who might say, I don't consider myself a Buddhist. I'm practicing Zen. Either I identify with a different religion, or no religion at all. But I just want the Zen meditation without the religion, the Buddhist element to it. And that's fair enough. We don't really care. We welcome anyone who wants to sit with us, and never mattered to me whether you consider yourself a Buddhist. Let me say, though, that traditionally the way that you become a Buddhist is by taking the three precepts. Excuse me, the three refuges, taking refuge in Buddha, taking refuge in Dharma, and taking refuge in Sangha. So some people would say that makes you a Buddhist, but you don't have to accept that. The other way that we grow into Buddhism is just through practice, through Zazen. And let me say more about that. If you sit long enough, if you do Zazen long enough years, then whatever you experience over those years, whatever insights you have about yourself and reality, the nature of things, relationships, those will, over time, come to reflect the Dharma, the teachings of Buddhism. But we don't need to make an issue about who considers herself a Buddhist and who doesn't. What I want to do is because the Rochester Zen Center is, officially at least, is a Zen Buddhist organization, I want to have a step back and see how Zen Buddhism, look at its place in the wider Buddhist culture in North America and Europe, the West, let's say. And I'm going to be reading from an article I've had for a long time, so long that I don't remember what the publication is. It's at the bottom of each page, it just says WQ, Spring 1997. I think it might be Western Quarterly. Anyone happen to know WQ?
Wilson Quarterly.
What is it?
Wilson Quarterly.
Wilson Quarterly. I've never even heard of that. And here I have an article from it. And the article is called Why Buddhism Baffles the West. And it's by Jan Natier, Natier. And in the introduction to this article, it says that, by the way, this is 1997, so over 20 years ago now. But I think it's essentially still valid, what the points made in here. The introduction says, Westerners today have such a one-dimensional picture of the faith the Buddha spawned. And I'm going to, of course, as usual, have to just select certain section of this article. It's too long to read. But it will begin with the statement by him or her that, and by the way, this Jan Natier, it says, is Associate Professor of Buddhist Studies at Indiana University. She is the author of Once Upon a Future Time, Studies in a Buddhist Prophecy of Decline. It's probably an allusion to this ancient contention that there are four phases that the Dharma will go through, and each successive one is in greater decline until you come to the what they call the Dharma ending age, the Kali Yuga. I've never thought that was worth thinking about too much. So here she begins. Religions, not just Buddhism, travel in three major ways: as import, as export, and as baggage, in quotation marks. It's an unfortunate word. We'll find better words for that as we go on here. Religions transmitted according to the import model are, so to speak, demand-driven. The consumer, that is the potential convert, actively seeks out the faith. Export religions are disseminated through missionary activity, while baggage religions are transmitted whenever individuals or families bring their beliefs along when they move to a new place. It is these divergent styles of transmission, not matters of doctrine, practice, or national origin, that have shaped the most crucial differences within American Buddhism. And then she begins with what she calls the import type. She says, consider a hypothetical example. A college student living in the Midwest in the 1950s finds a book on Zen Buddhism in the library and thinks it's the greatest thing he's ever heard of. So he buys a plane ticket, heads off to Japan, and begins to study meditation in the Zen temple. After several years of practice and some first-hand experience of Buddhist awakening, he returns to the United States and establishes a Zen center where he begins to teach this form of Buddhism to other Americans. So this is almost a profile of Roshi Kaplow, our founder, except he didn't live in the Midwest and used to kid me about my Midwest accent, by the way. She says here, the important point to note here is that the importer, in this case the college student, deliberately seeks out the product and takes the initiative to bring it home. Let me just pause. This is such an unusual situation. How many of us went straight to Japan or China or Korea after reading about Zen? And much less stayed years there and became teachers. That's a accurate description of most of us is having read, yes, maybe in the public library or college library, having read about Zen Buddhism, and then having found a teacher here in the United States who came from Japan, say, or who received his primary training and teaching from Japan and then became converts, to use that word. But for this to happen, that is, for us to take the initiative and go find the teacher and practice it, two crucial resources are required: money and leisure time. Buddhist groups of the import variety, same kind here, in other words, can be launched only by those who have a certain degree of economic privilege. And not surprisingly, in these groups, as in other voluntary associations, like attracts like. Thus, the upper middle class status of the founders tends to be reflected in their followers, with such communities drawing a mostly well-educated, financially comfortable, and overwhelmingly European-American constituency. All right, I think we can say that this pretty much characterizes our own sangha and most sanghas, most Zen sanghas in the West. I would say, just take a little issue with this, these two crucial resources that are required, money and leisure time. I don't hear of a lot of our members having much leisure time, though, of course, you have to have an hour a day or half an hour a day if you want to really be living Zen to do the sitting. But that's not a lot of leisure time. And then about the money, comfortable enough are provided for enough that you're not scrambling to eat, to find enough food to eat and maintain your shelter. I'm just a little uncomfortable with it being, it sounds a little as though it's such a privileged class that practices Buddhism in the West. Yes, privileged compared to others, to many, but I would say solidly middle class. Just that's how I see it anyway. And then she turns to the second category, which she described in one word as export. Oh, wait, more on this one, more on this, what also can be called convert or import. She says a convenient label for the groups formed by the import process then would be elite Buddhism. There it is again, that sort of privileged suggestion. But this kind of Buddhism is more than a matter of socio-economic background. At first glance, the groups belonging to this category would seem to span the full spectrum of Buddhist traditions. There are a number of schools of Tibetan Buddhism, various centers teaching meditation practices known as Vipassana, drawn primarily from Southeast Asia, and Japanese, Korean, and Chinese varieties of Zen. Yet a closer look reveals that what these groups all have in common is far more significant than the divergence in the sources of their inspiration. For the very names of two of these three types, Vipassana and Zen, mean meditation. On the level of practice, then, the most striking feature of elite Buddhism in America is its emphasis on meditation. Okay. To continue, meditation is, of course, part of the traditional repertoire of most, though not all, Asian Buddhist schools, at least for those who have undertaken a full-time monastic practice. What is distinctive about elite Buddhism, however, is not its heavy emphasis on meditation, but its scanting of other aspects of traditional Buddhism. For example, though monasticism has been the central Buddhist institution in the vast majority of Buddhist countries, elite Buddhists, meaning us, have been largely uninterested in becoming monks or nuns, preferring to see their Buddhist practice as a way of enhancing the quality of their lives as lay people. Well, I think this is self-evident. I've often mentioned it in Taisho, that that's just the way it is so far. In the West, that very, 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 very few, really virtually no practitioners do this full-time. Well, virtually none does it as traditional monks and nuns, and a very, very small percentage does it even in the kind of quasi-monastic training that we have, for example, here, what we call our staff, people who are in residential training here. for my whole career in Zen, I've been wondering why that is. Why is it that in the West we have so far, really no one has committed to monastic, true monasticism, the way it was done for 2,500 years in Buddhism. Of course, all I can come up with is just some speculation, so I won't go into that. But to continue here, while traditional Buddhists have spent a great deal of energy on activities that are best described as devotional, elite Buddhists, or convert Buddhists, import Buddhists, many of them still fleeing the theistic traditions of their youth, have little patience with such practices. And while codes of ethics have played a central role in traditional Buddhist societies, they have had little appeal for elite Buddhists, many of whom were drawn to Buddhism, but what they saw as its promise of a more spontaneous life. Indeed, until fairly recently, when scandals involving sexual affairs and financial mismanagement in several American, Tibetan, and Zen communities forced some serious rethinking, ethical codes were given almost no attention in elite Buddhist circles. Now, there we definitely, it's just simply not true of our own lineage, the Rochester Zen Center lineage. I think there is, or at least when she wrote this article, there was a lot of truth to what she's saying, is that there isn't a lot of attention, there wasn't a lot of attention paid to the precepts in a lot of American Zen centers. And by the way, the same is in Japanese Zen temples. Without backing up what I'm saying with evidence in particular, I know from having spent 6 months there and having worked at the side of Roshi Kaplow for many years, and drawing from what he said, there is very little importance placed, at least explicitly, on the precepts in Japan. But yes, because of the havoc that has occurred in a number of Tibetan and Zen centers in this country, I think there is more attention. Scanning the Buddhist, national Buddhist magazines, Lion's Roar, Buddha Dharma, and Tricycle, the covers are more commonly now featuring articles about the place of upright conduct, the precepts, thankfully. But anyway, she mentions three things then about those of us who have embraced Zen, three major differences from Asian Buddhism generally, is the monasticism, almost none of that in this hemisphere, the devotional elements that for, I think, many of us take a while to warm up to, and then the third is the role of upright conduct, or Shila, S-I-L-A. She continues, elite Buddhism thus represents, I hate that phrase, elite. It's convert, I think, is better. Thus represents not simply an Asian religion transplanted to a new environment, but a curious amalgamation of traditional Buddhist ideas and certain upper middle class American values. Above all, individualism, freedom of choice, and personal fulfillment. These, quote, non-negotiable cultural demands have reshaped Buddhist ideas and practices in significant ways, yielding a genuinely new religious product, in quotes, uniquely adapted to certain segments of the American, quote, market. And this last point that she's making is one that I'll take up in more depth next week in Tesha. Then she turns to the second, what she identifies as the second kind of Buddhism in the West, the export model. In this one, she says, encounters is a bit more of a missionary or evangelical type of Buddhism. This, of course, is not Zen. There's no place in Zen for proselytizing. But there is a whole branch of Buddhism that has come to the United States that is could be called evangelical or missionary Buddhism. And it's under the general umbrella of Nichiren Buddhism. Encounters with a missionary may take place on a street corner, in the subway, or even in one's home. Export religion, like Nichiren, is thus something of a wild card. It can attract a wide range of adherents, or it may appeal to no one at all. And one Buddhist organization in America, above all, fits this category, the Soka Gakkai International, which is or was a branch of Nichiren Buddhism. This group, whose name means Value Creating Study Association, I'm glad they changed the name, began its life in Japan in the 1930s as a lay association devoted to spreading the teachings of the Nichiren Shoshu school. According to this school, all beings have the potential for Buddhahood, but this inherent Buddha nature can only be made manifest through chanting of the mantra Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. These words, which literally mean homage to the Lotus Sutra, are believed to be powerful enough not just to change the practitioner's spiritual state, but to improve his or her material circumstances as well. So it's a form of Buddhism in which both material and spiritual happiness can be attained not through many lifetimes of strenuous practice or even weeks or months of meditation retreats, but through the daily recitation of a simple phrase. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this one simply because I think for most of us, I'm going to go out on a limb here, this is least appealing. Just by virtue of the fact that we're practicing Zen, the idea of chanting this one mantra and trying to get others to join, go out with strangers in public places and try to sign them up, is something that I don't have time to go into much, except this part of it. As she says, both the simplicity of the practice and the fact that this form of Buddhism addresses economic as well as spiritual needs has meant that the Soka Gakkai has had the potential to appeal to a very different and far less privileged audience than the convert Buddhist traditions. Only about half of Soka Gakkai members have attended college, and barely a quarter hold bachelor's degrees. Statistics compiled by the Soka Gakkai itself show a wide range of educational levels and occupations. My own observations, she says, suggest a center of gravity in the lower middle class. So it is in the ethnicity of its members that the distinctiveness of the Soka Gakkai is most obvious, for it has attracted a following that includes large numbers of Latinos, African Americans, and Asian Americans. According to a 1983 survey, fully 55% of its members had non-European ethnic backgrounds. So, big difference from those of us who have come to Zen practice and, I suppose, Tibetan Buddhist practice and Vipassana practice. Soka Gakkai was established by missionaries accountable to their Japanese home organization. So it's been able to, she says, limit the extent of its adaptation to American values. One former member remarked that the only real difference between the American and the Japanese Soka Gakkai is that members in America usually sit on chairs. If you hear of, let's say, celebrities or people in Hollywood who call themselves Buddhists, like Tina Turner comes to mind. I don't know. There are others. They say that they identify with the Nichiren school, and maybe more narrowly with the Soka Gakkai. The idea is that if you do this chant, Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, fervently enough, continuously enough, then you can acquire material things like a good car, a nice girlfriend or boyfriend, or win the lottery, things like that. And then the third kind. Oh wait, one last thing about this evangelical Buddhism, like Nichiren Buddhism. The Soka Gakkai has been able to tap into the American dream of upward mobility, a dream that has often been difficult to realize for those who find the obstacles of racism and exclusion in their path. So that's wonderful that there is a practice like this that works for large numbers of people who would not be attracted to Zen. Different strokes for different folks. This is the wonderful thing about a world of different religions, is that different religions appeal to different people. So let's then, moving on to the third type, what she unfortunately called baggage Buddhism, which has acquired a pejorative connotation. Let's substitute for that hereditary Buddhism or ethnic Buddhism. These are the Buddhists who are simply born into the faith of their ancestors. Like export Buddhism, this type involves travel to America by Buddhists from Asian countries. But the migration is not for religious purposes. Instead, these Buddhists, or their ancestors, came as immigrants to the United States to pursue economic opportunity, or, especially in the case of recent refugees from Southeast Asia, so, for example, Vietnam, to escape persecution at home. Ethnic Buddhists span the full range of schools and national origins, ranging from Theravadins from Cambodia to Mahayanists from Korea to Kalmyk Mongols of the Vajrayana school. But to the outsider, these organizations display remarkable similarities. Above all, they tend to be deliberately mono-ethnic in membership at the outset, for they serve not only religious purposes, but operate as supportive community centers as well. Such temples may provide language lessons, a place to network for jobs, and above all, a place to relax with others who share one's own cultural assumptions and to whom nothing needs to be explained. It is only in Buddhist groups of this type that ethnicity serves as the primary defining feature. And so she adopts the phrase ethnic Buddhism. And then she says that the communication across these three categories, that is, import or convert Buddhists, evangelical Buddhists and ethnic Buddhists is often difficult, even non-existent. And let me just say, is that a problem? Different people are drawn to different forms of the Dharma. Bravo! Then we don't need to all try to pack into one place, one category. The problem comes if we look down on the others, then just like looking down on other individuals or anyone in our life, that's itself betrays the principles of the Dharma. She says that in the import, that's us, we do find considerable exchange. Participants move easily from Vipassana to Tibetan Buddhism to Zen. Yet, she says, elite import Buddhists do not accord the same acceptance to members of evangelical and ethnic Buddhist groups. This is important now. They do not accord the same level of acceptance to members of evangelical and ethnic Buddhist groups. Since they do not practice meditation, so the reasoning goes, members of these two latter groups cannot be considered genuine, in quotes, genuine Buddhists. And this is, of course, something that is regrettable, that you would see those who don't practice meditation as not true Buddhists. You know, the word Buddhism, I read somewhere a long time ago, was some kind of a Catholic missionary in the 19th century, or maybe, yeah, the 19th century, I think, or the 20th century, when Japan was just opening up to foreigners, he came up with this term, Buddhism. Until then, it had just been known as the Dharma, whatever the local word was for the Dharma. In India, it'd be the Dharma. In Southeast Asia, it'd be the Dhamma. And in Japan, I think it was Ho. And China had its own word. But this missionary saw these Buddha figures in these temples, monasteries, and just came up with the word Buddhists. But I think some of us who were uncomfortable with the word Buddhism, or are uncomfortable with the word Buddhism, might feel more ease with just saying that we're trying to practice the Dharma, the way. Now I'm going to flip over to an article before I continue. An article in a Buddha Dharma, an issue, a winter 2016 issue of Buddha Dharma by an assistant professor of American Studies at San Jose State University, who also serves on the board of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. Her name is Funia Shu. Now the last name is HSU. She is quite exercised about Asian Buddhists, that is ethnic Buddhists, those who immigrated here from Asian countries, being looked down on or not being included enough in the discussion of Buddhism in the United States. She uses the phrase racial othering. She says, just to read a few sentences, the name of the article is We've Been Here All Along. Funia Shu says it's time to recognize the contributions of Asian American Buddhists and face up to the cultural appropriation that has all but rendered them invisible in mainstream white American Buddhism. She says the exclusion of Asian and Asian American Buddhists from conversations on American Buddhism is cultural appropriation. It renders invisible our foundational role in establishing and maintaining Buddhism in America despite white supremacy. Thus, such erasure denies our right to claim our deep and specific connection, indeed our centrality, to American Buddhism. It appropriates our historical authority in order to promote the white ownership of an indigenous Asian practice for liberation. I'll just say, I think, as after reading this article, I think she really has an axe to grind, but she also has some important points to make, is that we too easily ignore the importance of our Asian predecessors and our Asian members. This practice wouldn't be here, of course, without its origins in Asia. In practical terms, what that means in terms of including Asian Americans in the conversation is not quite clear. I'll read a little more of this quite strong article. She says, most conversations about cultural appropriation in Buddhism revolve around the outward symbols and signs of the practice. Beads, tattoos, statues, and so on. Now, hold the phone. To call this cultural appropriation, that we honor our Buddha nature in the form of Buddha figures, I think is unfair. We're preserving something central to the forms, not the essence, but to the forms of our tradition by having Buddha figures. These robes that we wear for sitting, if people who want to, also maybe she would think is cultural appropriation, but they are very practical too, to shed your street clothes and with it possible issues of fashion and class, and to join in with others by wearing these very comfortable, loose-fitting robes has a lot of good sense behind it, although we don't require anyone outside Sashin to wear these robes. She says, an important element of the appropriation occurs through the assumed occupation of white authority status, often legitimized through the intellectual study of Buddhism. I'm running out of time here, so I can't go too much into what more she says, but I think she has a valid point that we need to acknowledge the great contribution of our predecessors, of course, and we should, and that's one reason for this Taisho, is to acknowledge that omission. On the other hand, this is the United States, this is the West, and it's only natural that we that it has acquired Western forms and language, idioms. When Buddhism went from China to Japan and Korea, it didn't remain just as Chinese, it became Japanized and Koreanized. This is just natural. Any religion, or just even let's say practice, has to be adapted to the culture or the country of the people practicing it. Otherwise, it's not going to fly. But to think that that ethnic Buddhists, because if they don't do meditation, are not true Buddhists is just silly. And just a historical note here that the Soka Gakkai, remember, that's a branch, and from what I've heard from Roshi Kaplow and others, a kind of a militant, aggressive branch of the Nichiren school. It was formally excommunicated by its parent organization, Nichiren Shoshu. We'll go into that. But to give her more this Funye Shu, to give her more of her argument here, she says in a fall 2000 special issue of Turning Wheel, the Journal of Socially Engaged Buddhism, dedicated to addressing the underrepresentation of Buddhists of Asian descent in the U.S., guest editors so and so and so and so shared the following reflection. Not long ago, this is a quote, a prominent European-American Buddhist related that during a trip to Japan, she discovered that she knew more about Zen than most Japanese. That's what I found, too, when I was in Japan. This innocent remark reflects some all-too-common perceptions often held by non-Asian Buddhists, that they are, quote, more knowledgeable about Buddhism, that they practice real Buddhism, as opposed to folk Buddhism. Indeed, Asian and Asian American Buddhist practices have often been dismissed as superstitious, inauthentic forms of Buddhism. In mainstream white American Buddhist conversations, white Buddhists are often heralded as the erudite saviors and purifiers of Buddhism. This perspective exemplifies the subtle enactments and overwhelming hubris of white supremacy. In positioning a certain type of Buddhism, white, as better than other kinds of Buddhism, Asian, folk, baggage Buddhism, the white ownership of Buddhism is claimed through delegitimizing the validity and long history of our traditions, then appropriating the practices on the pretext of performing them more correctly. Well, I don't think we do that here, but maybe unconsciously it's worth hearing this, it's worth hearing this in case there are unconscious biases that have crept in for some of us. Let me, to be fair, point out that that in Japan, according to Roshi Kaplow, who spent 13 years there, there is a similar bias, cultural bias, that, as he said, that no Westerner could ever really understand the essence of Zen. And that's one reason, if I may disclose this, one reason that Roshi suddenly felt he needed to come home, he felt he would never be accepted, fully accepted in Japan, just simply because he was a Westerner. And one more anecdote. I spent 3 months at each of two Zen temples in Japan, and each time when I left, the two times that I left those, I had tea with the Roshi. When I left Bukokuji, the teacher there, Tangen Roshi, said to me, Zen is dying in Japan and being reborn in the United States. And then after 3 months at Sogenji, the Roshi there, when we said goodbye, said, wait for it, Zen is dying in Japan and being reborn in the United States. So it's not just blarney to think that we might have something in this hemisphere to bring to the to Buddhism and to the revival even of Buddhism. And furthermore, let me say that according to a book by an American Buddhist Zen priest who spent 29 years in Japan, most Zen temples in Japan don't practice meditation. They don't sit. Does that mean that they're lesser? They're not Buddhist, true Buddhists? No, not necessarily. But they certainly can't be called true Zen practitioners. Zen means meditation. So I think we do definitely have to be aware of how we might be looking down on those who don't practice meditation or Buddhists of other kinds. But at the same time, we can't deny that there are differences, and that I think there's great hope if we can keep sitting, make sitting the core of our practice. There's great hope that we might bring a and preserve a viable form of the Dharma in this country. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to the brave endless blind passions. I bow to the brute Dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain
time.